out of all those characters that we watched during that blaxploitation period, the 60s or whatever, he's the enduring one. He's the one that when you hear, you know, bong, 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 you immediately go, wow, Shaft.
That was Samuel L. Jackson talking about Shaft.
He's a bad mother.
He is.
Should I shut my mouth?
We're talking Shaft this week. We're talking The Dead Don't Die, the Jim Jarmusch film with Bill Murray and Adam Driver. We're talking Late Night with Mindy Kaling and Emma Thompson. Maybe a little bit of the Tonys. Maybe. I'm Neil Rose.
I'm snoring already.
Sitting around talking movies, joined as always by Bill Bregoli.
Today's New York City forecast calls for scattered helicopters.
Oh, wow. My. Too soon?
What's your too? And Bill McCuddy. What's your too soon comeback line, Bill, when you do stand-up?
When I do a joke and about something like, let's say, the helicopter, and people say too soon, I go, you're right, I'll tell it again in 5 minutes.
There you go.
There you go. There you go.
That always gets a chuckle.
Bill Bregoli, tell us about Shaft, which I saw, too.
Yeah. It was very Shaftable. It opens with Shaft and his gal, played by Regina Hall, and she points out to him that she's taken off. She can't stand this life anymore.
It's a flashback. From the 80s,
right.
Early 80s.
And is that Ellie of Ellie's Love Theme from the original Shaft?
No, it isn't. Her name is Sam or something.
Regina King.
Yeah. And she points out that in the back seat is Baby Shaft gurgling away. And then they flash forward 20-something years. In the interim, Shaft keeps sending his son inappropriate gifts for his birthday, but that's the only contact he has with him is when the son opens up a box of condoms and he's 7 years old or
funny.
A Super Bowl ring.
Funny stuff.
And then years later, it turns out the son is working for the man. He's a data analyst for the FBI. His son's best friend dies, and he joins forces with his dad to solve the murder mystery, and millennial jokes ensue.
Well, I expected nothing from this movie, and I was pleasantly surprised. I had a good time. I thought it was very funny. The thing is played predominantly for laughs. It's an action comedy with, I'd say, the emphasis is on comedy.
Yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson, who I also did the Shaft Junket, and I spoke to him before I even it was up in Harlem. And we were just hanging out at Red Rooster, which is a restaurant out there. And he was eating. And I said, that was funny. He goes, I could be funny. I said, yes, I know. I've seen Pulp Fiction. But
did you get to eat there? Was that part of the junket? You got to eat at Red Rooster?
They had food at Red Rooster. But the second I got there, I was talking to him for like a minute. And they whisked you to some other place. There were all these locations all around Harlem. Like, they were different. As opposed to doing a junket, where all the rooms are on the same floor of, generally speaking, a central location like a hotel. One room was in a brownstone. One room was, where was the other room? In a place called Harlem Shake. They would take you around.
Because there's a club underneath Red Rooster. That's Marcus Samuelson's restaurant,
yes,
by the way, for you Food Channel viewers.
That's where we did the Samuel L. Jackson interview.
Downstairs there.
But, there was food. There was no time to eat. They were just whisking you around. I even did a stand-up by the Cotton Club where they had that Chevelle.
Chevrolet?
Yeah, they had from the movie. And you did a stand-up in there, and they gave you a Shaft coat, which I'll probably never use. But, you know, as long as I
big,
was
big, long leather coat?
What?
Did you know Giorgio Armani did the coats?
Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah, but this was like a baseball, right? Like a, what kind of coat is it?
It was a long...
It's a duster.
Oh, it's a duster? Really?
I'd say, how would I describe this color? Orangey, brown,
yeah.
Coat that went from shoulder to almost to the floor.
And there's a joke, in the movie where he wears this long coat and the woman calls him, you Matrix-looking mother, blah, blah, blah. And he says, I'm tired of these Lawrence Fishburne comparisons.
Wow. So Bill asked me to ask a question to Samuel L. Jackson, which I did. Samuel L. Jackson was paired with Richard Roundtree, the original Shaft from 1971. First question was Bill McCuddy's question. So I look at all three of them and I say, what is the better soundtrack, Superfly or Shaft? Richard Roundtree looks at me and says, did you really ask that question? Are you really going to ask that question? And I just paused, you know, I wasn't thrown by it. I've been doing these things for 30 some odd years. And I just looked at him and he looked at me and I said, okay, then, moving on. You don't like that question. We'll move on to another question. And then we just moved on to other questions about...
Did you ask Samuel Jackson if he'd ever done any private detective work in his own life?
No, there was 5 minutes.
You were throwing the Bill... That was... You threw the only Bill McCuddy question I can't use out. And then the one I could, no. All right.
No, we talked about...
the legacy
and
of Shaft.
Changing the time. Well, we did talk about... I said to Richard Roundtree, what's the biggest difference that you see filming a movie in Harlem now, then just in terms
probably
of
they really shot it in Atlanta.
Just in terms of the filming aspect of it, then right. So he says most of the film was shot in Atlanta. We did do some location work in Harlem, but Richard Roundtree said, you know, I got off the out of the car when we first arrived in Harlem, and I said, you know, there's all these white people here. What's going on? He said, where'd all the black people go? You know. And Harlem is, I mean, having spent the day doing that junket in Harlem, it has gentrified. It is not the Harlem from the original Shaft.
Well, originally, it was a Jewish neighborhood.
Originally, you know, one of the interview rooms was in a vintage Harlem brownstone that I got a tour of that they renovated. You actually did the interview with the director outside the brownstone. But I was very interested, and this guy gave me a tour of the brownstone, and he said originally it was a upper middle class neighborhood. Then it became a Jewish neighborhood, then it became an urban African American neighborhood, and I said, so it's come full circle. He goes, no, it's even more upscale now, you know. And this townhouse was breathtaking. I mean, the guy said he bought it for like $395,000. It's worth 10 times that now. And he said it was in its last incarnation before he turned it into this beautiful brownstone living space. It was a boarding house, and he said he had to knock down walls. It was just it was a dilapidated mess. He goes, they used to call me in the neighborhood not by my name. They called me the white guy. That's what they called him in the neighborhood. And now
that's the landlord.
Yeah. So
the Beau Bridges movie that Hal Ashby did, right?
It's a Hal Ashby movie. Yeah, but it's. Harlem is, they say now you move to Harlem, you say you live in Harlem, they think you're a wealthy person, you know? So, but anyway, back to the movie.
So we won't be moving there, you're saying.
It's the most politically incorrect thing that I've watched in years. I mean, it is a misogynistic, they are not going for ruffling anybody's feathers. And, you know, Bill McCuddy and I have talked about this, the fact that there's too much political correctness to a fault, you know, in comedy these days, you know, that you can't really say anything. And this movie didn't really give a shit. They were just like kind of, you know, he's telling his son, this is how you got to deal with women. This is what you got to do. You know, and I'm just listening to this, nodding my head in disbelief. I can't believe I'm watching this in 2019 on a screen. But that said, it's a fun movie.
But the son is like, incredulous at this advice, right? He's like,
for most of it.
Correct.
Toward the end.
Oh, I get it. I can see the end coming a mile
it's
away.
It's a baton passing
he
movie.
Gets his,
and you
he
don't...
gets his groove back, or he puts his. He gets.
Well, the son
becomes
a kid who went to MIT,
right?
Who's got this desk job, a computer analyst at the FBI. He's not an agent, and he's got a real son of a bitch boss, and he's a straight laced guy. He doesn't want to break all the rules, and then he needs his father. This is not giving really anything away. This is the beginning of the movie because his best friend dies and he doesn't think that it's accidental. He thinks that he was murdered. So his father, who he hasn't seen in decades, he goes to see him and says, I need your help. And they have a very bitter relationship. You were never there for me, blah, blah, blah. But the father, Samuel L. Jackson, keeps trying to impart these archaic tips to his son on how to, you know, deal with women and be street smart and do all these things. And the son is like, this is, you know, break the rules. This is just not right. And I'm not doing this. But as Bill said, for a while.
For a while. Yeah. And, yeah, and but I don't want to see the baton pass to Usher. I don't believe this guy as the next Shaft. If that's what their intention is, maybe they're just going to end this franchise. Because I can't see that kid carrying it on.
Well, is this going to be a big success? I mean, does it?
It'll
do
well.
I think it's heresy to make the Shaft franchise into a comedy franchise, but that's just me being
It's like a it's comedy in the way that Beverly Hills Cop was a comedy, where it's comedic, and you got Eddie Murphy, and it's funny, but there's also like a fair share amount of action in there.
Is it that good?
No, the plot.
No,
you know what the mystery, the murder mystery they're trying to solve. I solved in like 5 minutes.
It's like a Scooby-Doo mystery.
Yeah, it's like it's a front and blah blah blah, and I knew it.
Yeah, well, there's a scene in the beginning. I won't give it away where they go somewhere, and I'm going.
But I'll describe it.
These guys. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
this is not on the up and up.
I know. But did you enjoy it?
Pretty much. I saw a lot of the jokes coming like 10 miles away, to be honest with you.
But Samuel L. Jackson was funny, don't you think? I mean...
He can be funny.
To use the Samuel L. Jackson line, yeah.
Yeah, no, he's fine. I thought it was an okay comedy and fine action.
Well, you guys have not talked me into spending money to go see this thing. But when it comes on demand, I probably will give it a look.
I don't know. I say...
The trailer looks really broad.
Pleasantly surprised and expected nothing and said, like, okay, I'm doing the junket. I got to see the movie. And I was laughing and pleasantly surprised.
Does it? I have to ask, since you asked them about the soundtrack, how's the soundtrack to this?
You know,
it's mostly variations on the theme.
Exactly.
Did Usher do it? I mean, I guess you would have asked him if you'd known it was Usher.
I think I would have. No, but you would have. There was no, like, vocal tunes in it. I mean, it was... predominantly a
variation, you know, on the Shaft thing.
That wah-wah guitar pedal guitar. It was throughout the whole movie. You got variations, as Bill said, on that tune. I did ask Samuel L. Jackson later in the day. I saw him later. I said, I'm sorry you didn't like my soundtrack question. And he goes, well, it's like comparing Isaac. How do you compare Isaac Hayes to Curtis Mayfield? You know,
well, I think that was in the intent of the question, was to compare those two.
So nobody really wanted to answer the question, but Roundtree was like...
For the record, for people listening, Shaft is a better theme song, but
Superfly
is a better soundtrack.
You got Freddy's Dead, you got Pusher Man, you got the title track Superfly, and there's not really any hits in Shaft, except for the song Shaft, which won an Oscar. I remember Isaac Hayes sitting there...
The whole soundtrack won the Oscar. And he was in chains, and I just thought...
He was in chains.
I went crazy. I was watching that home in Traverse City, Michigan, and I said, this is never going to happen to a black man in Hollywood. And my mom was like, well, just wait and see.
And they had, like, smoke coming up out of the stage. Yeah, I remember that.
And he won.
I know. Well, sadly, that was almost 50 years ago, Bill. It was like...
Amazing.
Time flies, man. Time flies. I was a kid, too. All right, moving on. Let's talk about... The Dead Don't Die, which is a Jim Jarmusch movie, which Bill McCuddy is going to see because we're going to be doing it on the next Talking Pictures television show, which, by the way, all month is on Fridays on All Arts Channel in New York. You can get it anywhere in the tri-state area. All Arts, just Google it. We're on at 9:30.
That's the channel you go by when you're looking for something good.
Well,
and you go,
on
what
Spectrum,
is
it's channel 1276.
I forget the number, but it's
on Verizon. It's 144.
But this Arts channel is not. It's two numbers less than infinity. Whatever that.
Well, it's on
cherry
is.
Pie.
Well, we're on Fridays at 9:30, 2:30, and
this shameless plug is brought to you by LaCroix.
And 7:30 in the evening. So, and we're on all month, and then we'll be on monthly, as in addition to CUNY. So, The Dead Don't Die is a Jim Jarmusch film, and I like Jim Jarmusch. I mean, Jim Jarmusch, from his very first movie, Stranger Than Paradise, to Down by Law, he's got this slow, meandering, deadpan sense of humor that you kind of either gravitate to it or you don't. And in many of his past movies, Night on Earth is another one that comes to mind. It works. And
Dead Flowers,
funny.
Is that it? Or Wilted Flowers? What's that one with Bill
but
Murray?
This one just lied there like an egg. It was, you know, Adam Driver and Bill Murray and Chloe Sevigny are three cops in this small town that get invaded by zombies. And Tom Waits is this guy that lives in the wilderness And Steve Buscemi is this other lunatic who's wearing a hat, a Trump hat, except instead of saying
"What
Make
a
America
cast!"
Great,
this thing doesn't sound like it could lose.
Selena Gomez is in this thing. Tilda Swinton is in this thing.
Man,
and I'm not even done. I am not even done. I sat with my wife, and when they run the credits in the beginning, over just type on a black screen, she's going, "Man, this is a cast. It's like exactly what you said." But it just lies there. It is.
Mrs.
Just,
Rosen is the brains of the outfit, by the way.
It
in
is
that
just deadly to use. You know, it's about the undead. It's deadly. It's not funny. It's not interesting. The action isn't good. It's supposed to be a deadpan comedy, and it's
just more, a dead comedy.
More just dead a dead pan. Comedy
that you're panning. Well, boy, I love this game because you've talked me out of seeing this movie now.
Well, you had
I am
you.
Nope. No, you've done a great job. Neil.
I wasn't going to see it to begin with because somebody said Jim Jarmusch.
Well, Bill McCuddy
really?
Has to see it for the show.
The best thing, one of the best things Jim Jarmusch did
but
was he played himself in Bored to Death. That Jason, do you remember that Jason Schwartzman HBO series?
Bored to Death show. Yeah. Ted Danson.
Ted Danson. And Jarmusch was in that.
Jake Zach Galifianakis and Jason Schwartzman. So here's the thing. I know you're going to see it for the show, but I have to tell you something.
No, I'm really not now.
Yeah, you're seeing it. The audience seemed to love it.
What?
And they were laughing and howling through the movie. One guy even was applauding. So, you know, like Booksmart, Bill McCuddy, which I didn't
Brilliant.
Like. And
opening
everybody
wider,
seemed to
every
like
weekend.
It. You know, I'm telling you that, you know, don't go by me. You might go like there's a lot of in jokes that I didn't find particularly funny that the audience was howling at. You might go, you're crazy. This is,
you know, you've been doing this a long time, Neil, and I don't say this lightly. You are one of the like last men standing in the world of film criticism. And I think for your slogan, and here's your ride, by the way, just outside. I think your slogan, for those of you who didn't hear it, there's a siren in the background. Bill has some rumble filter on, so maybe you didn't hear it.
That's not a rumble.
So I think it's taken you this long, but you've come up with the quintessential slogan for you, which is Neil Rosen, film critic, don't go by me. That says it all.
When I was starting out, doing movie reviews.
And now I will go see this movie.
And I was in my late 20s. I was on a show called The Joey Reynolds Show on WNBC. WNBC, 66 AM radio. And it was the show that replaced Howard Stern in the afternoons after they fired him on NBC.
This was in the late 20s, you said? Before the Depression?
This was in the 1980s.
Oh, okay.
And early 1980s.
You were in your 20s.
And I was in my 20s. And what happened was I was their movie critic, and I would come on like a few times a week, and we'd talk movies, and I'd sit with their, just like Howard, they were trying to like, they replaced Howard with Joey Reynolds, and Joey Reynolds had a cast of characters just like Howard had a cast of characters, and I would sit with this cast of characters and for the whole show, and they would do bits and stuff, and then it would be my time, and I'd talk about movies and whatever. So I remember the movie Purple Rain came out. And I reviewed Purple Rain. And one of the cast of characters said to me, you know, well, Judith Crist, who was a big critic at the time, she wrote for many publications, but at the time she was actually writing for TV Guide, which was a big publication back then. And she goes, well, Judith Crist didn't like it. And I made everybody laugh by saying, well, that's just what we need to review a Prince movie, is a 75-year-old woman, you know, with her take on, you know, a Prince movie. And everybody thought that that was clever, but it was true. I wasn't even trying to be funny. So now I find myself, I'm not 75, I'm nowhere near that, but, you know, reviewing, when it comes to reviewing a millennial type of movie.
I think you could pass for 75 in a crowd.
I don't think so. But, well, Bill and I are the same age. We're all basically the same age here. We won't mention what that number is. Nonetheless, I will say, what did you say?
Nothing. I'm quiet. It's the oldest in the room.
Nonetheless, yeah, I find myself, if I have to review like some, you know, millennial hip hop movie or something like that, you know, are any of us really the right guy to review that?
Well, you didn't get Booksmart, so this doesn't surprise me at all. But you think this is a millennial based comedy made by Jim Jarmusch?
No, it's not at all. I don't know how we got onto this.
So who was laughing?
The entire screening room. And
right.
They were not,
but I mean,
and they were not. Which we've gone to many screenings where they fill the screening room up with audience extra type of people who are just happy to be there. These were bona fide critics that were laughing.
Huh.
And I'm there saying no to myself, am I, critics. You know, am I the, you know, what am I missing here? You know, so I don't know. I'd be curious to know what you think of the movie. To me, it went nowhere. It was boring. It was deadly.
Well, yeah, I've heard this, by the way, and I think it's. I shouldn't say this without
what
looking
a waste
it up.
Of Bill.
I
Murray
think it's tracking at about 60% on Rotten Tomatoes.
You got Bill Murray, and I mean, you got a big cast there. You know what I mean? And it's all just played deadpan. Anyway, moving on. Bill McCuddy, tell us about Late Night.
Oh, this was.
Oh, by the way, do you have any interest in seeing? You said
I'd
no.
like to, but I
dead the dead.
Oh, the dead. No, I as soon as you said Jim Jarmusch, I lost interest immediately.
And I want to see it because everyone else laughed, and they're probably right. So, although I have heard that it's not great. So, Mindy Kaling was kind of the splash of Sundance, I guess, right? Where this Amazon plucked this movie up for I think $12 million. It's about. It sort of takes her backstage work at the TV show The Office and turns it into a late night environment. She is a writer, a comedy writer. Doesn't start out that way. She's actually working in a power plant. But
chemical plant.
Chemical plant. It's a running joke in the movie. She, through circumstances that would take too long to describe, gets an interview and funny circumstances, actually. I won't spoil it for you. She ends up getting a job because they need a woman, then this all-white male staff, for Emma Thompson, who's kind of the Stephen Colbert with breasts of Late Night. And she's kind of the reigning queen, but she's kind of lagging in the ratings a little bit. And they may actually end up canning her and replacing her with a hip young comic. She gets wind of that, and Kaling says, here's what you need to do, and starts suggesting things to this all-male white staff. And of course, at first, they hate every one of her ideas. And then lo and behold, they start doing some of this stuff, and like taking Emma Thompson out on the street and having her hail a cab for black guys and other stuff like that, which, by the way, is a bit that Michael Moore did in his show like years ago. But in a movie. But look, it's Mindy Kaling is a talented writer. The movie has a certain amount of charm. And if it wasn't for Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling, this probably wouldn't be as good as it is. But I'm going to recommend it on the CUNY show and here on this one because it's opening wider this weekend. And I'd like to see it find an audience.
I like the movie. There were a couple of things that I found a little unrealistic. Emma Thompson, who hosts a show called Tonight, I guess she's hosting The Tonight Show or something. She was the queen of late night. She's not particularly a likable presence, not only off screen, her character, but on screen. And it's hard for me to see why she would be the reigning queen of late night for so many years.
Well, I don't think David Letterman was considered likable, per se, in that typical television way. I think they're presenting her.
They called him acerbic.
Yeah, I think they're presenting her as sort of this alternative taste. She gets an award right in the very beginning of the movie, and she says, congratulations on giving a British woman the American Comedy Award. I guess you've run out of funny people here or something. So she's very much kind of in on her own joke. The problem is she's gotten a little stale.
Well, that's the thing. Her show hits the skids, and Kaling, who is a diversity hire, has to prove herself. She got in because through a diversity, thing. And now that she's there, she's there now. She has to prove herself. I like the dynamic between Kaling and Thompson, the way that develops. I think that's good. I think Kaling's appealing. I like the fact that she comes to work, the first day, like baking cupcakes for everybody and wearing this, kind of like business woman attire suit, and nobody cares. You know, she's just like... she doesn't even have a seat when she goes into that first meeting. She has to sit on a garbage pail, turned upside down. But it's appealing. I mean, it's not as edgy as, let's say, I love the late night backstage peek at late night shows. It's no Larry Sanders,
standard. That is the gold standard.
You know, but it's more mainstream, but that's okay. I liked it. I thought Thompson
diverting,
was good.
Pleasant. You give it a recommendation or
yeah,
no?
Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. I would say I'd give it like 3 apples.
Bill, have we talked you into...
Yeah, you might. I might.
Channel surfing over to Late Night?
Sure, I might. Give it a try.
Kaling is...
Kaling? I thought it was Kaling.
Yeah, Kaling. You keep saying Kaling.
Kaling, as you said, Bill McCuddy. Yeah, she based some of this on her She started out as an intern, actually.
You want a cup of coffee? I have a Keurig coffee maker if you want a cup of coffee.
Why are you offering me coffee?
That's because it's called Keurig, not Keurig.
Oh, okay. Kaling.
Yeah.
Kaling, you know, she, I think she started out as an intern on Conan or somewhere. I don't know. But she worked her way up, and she was a writer, as you said, on The Office. I don't know. Was she hired as a writer, or because she was on
she was.
That show?
No, she was, and then she got what was supposed to be just a small cameo that bloomed into her playing that part.
Yeah, and it's directed by a woman, which Lisa Rossman, who does the TV show, will probably find terrific. So it's a woman-based film, but I liked it, and I recommend it. And I'm glad that we convinced Bill Bregoli to see the film. Any other point? Any other comments on it?
No, I think we can move on. Yes, okay, if fine. You're regrouping.
All right, and moving on. Okay. All right. So the Tony Awards were this past Sunday.
Okay, let's move on beyond those two.
And you know,
how was Corden? Was he good?
Well, before I get to that, I wonder.
Boy. Yeah, make this story even longer if you can.
I wonder when I watch the Tony Awards, and, you know, I live in New York, and I see a lot of these things. Elaine May gave a great acceptance speech, and she was
Like 87, right?
She played a woman with Alzheimer's in the Waverly Chronicles. I saw the play. She was really tremendous in it. So she deserved that win. And her, you know, she's Elaine May. She's a comedy legend. Her acceptance speech was quite funny. But I wonder when you watch it, you know, unlike if you watch the Oscars or you watch the Grammys, or you watch the Emmys, certainly, where most people are rooting for certain people. And, yeah, I like that. You know, if you watch the Emmys, you haven't seen all the shows, but you're waiting to see, oh, I love Handmaid's Tale or something, and you're waiting to see if Elizabeth Moss is going to win or, you know, whatever it is. I love Letterman or, you know, I'm so sorry, Colbert, I want to see if he wins, whatever it is. But outside of New York, you know, how many people know who these people are?
Well, that's like saying there shouldn't be an Independent Spirit Awards.
No, I'm not
because
saying there shouldn't be. I'm just wondering how enjoyable is it once you get past
the ratings weren't huge.
They were bad.
Yeah, they've never been huge. I don't know why this is still on a network television station.
Yeah, it
I mean,
PBS,
it's
PBS really.
Well,
yeah, or
they
streamed,
do,
or they stream some of it beforehand.
I think
right?
they do a couple of hours beforehand.
Yeah.
Where they give you because they keep showing you through the show. I didn't watch the whole show. I watched the opening.
By the way, they started doing that 2 years ago, and I looked at my tweets from 2 years ago because it was like 2 year anniversary of it. And I said 2 years ago, why doesn't the Oscars do the same thing? Why don't they give out those Oscars beforehand and then that day and then bump in with them?
They
as
do on
bumpers.
The Oscars. They say
no. They
in
do
a ceremony held
yeah 3 weeks ago.
Week.
Yeah, so it's all announced and it's old news by then. They yeah. should do the same thing at the Oscars.
With the Tonys, you mean? With the
no,
Oscars.
At the Oscars. Well, what the Tonys do, they should do at the Oscars.
But they are doing that with the Oscars.
Yeah, but they do it 3 weeks earlier. I'm saying, how many
that
times
day.
Do I have to say this?
Well, you know.
Are you taking Elaine May's place in this
they tried
play?
To. They tried to eliminate two of the categories in the Oscars. It was either this year or the year before.
Yeah,
there was
yeah.
a big uproar over it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What was it that they wanted
it
to remove?
Makeup.
They wanted to take one of the categories out of the
cinematography,
show.
Cinematography, I think.
Cinematography,
and they wanted
yeah.
to put
yeah.
it in the...
Well, they were going
to
rotate the two categories.
And they were going to put it in the earlier show. And right. they said, no. No, no, no. There was a big protest uproar over it. There was also news that they're moving the Oscars back now to the end of February.
Yeah.
That came out the other
okay.
day.
That's
when was it this year? March?
Yeah, it was in March.
Okay.
It used to always be February, but then they started running into the Winter Olympics every 4 years things like that. They'd push it back.
Well, anyway, the opening number was a big Broadway, wasn't a comedy number, it was just a big Broadway blockbuster bonanza number with tons of chorus line dancers, and they even played a couple of bars from the musical Chorus Line. And yeah, I mean, it was okay, you know, and once they get past the opening number and they do a little bit, he didn't really do a monologue, although I left after I turned it off at the opening number. My wife said he didn't do a monologue. He did some bit with the audience.
And they did carpool karaoke during the breaks, I heard, like for only the audience in the audience.
Oh. But then it just becomes, you know, presenters with categories and nominees for the mm-hmm. most part, you know. So I thought the opening number was nice, you know, if you like Broadway.
Well, Bregoli was telling me a story before about when somebody's coming to town and they're looking for a show, the Tonys helps them. The Tonys, they can watch, and they go, oh, we're coming to New York. We'll get tickets to Hadestown, or we'll get tickets to...
Yeah. Okay. It's good for that.
I mean, it's always been kind of a commercial for Broadway.
Well, to answer your question about... That's true. To answer your question about, you think that, why is this on a network show? So, on a network, why are they running the Tony Awards? Okay, it's June. Pretty much most things are in reruns. What are they going to run, Bill? A rerun of NCIS or...
I think they could probably find something that gets more than... What did this thing get? Like 5 million people?
Yeah, barely. Well, you see, NBC has Stanley Cup, and ABC has the NBA Finals.
So it was up against an NBA Final game and a Stanley Cup Final game?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that the Stanley
Although we Cup have to say it's probably three distinctly different audiences.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
But CBS Metro's credit does do golf.
I am and they do tennis.
Yeah, I know.
The elitist sports. I'm surprised that the Stanley Cup Final game would go on the same time as the NBA Final.
Well, it did.
Okay.
The puck drop.
I thought you were going to say,
puck drop at 8:20.
And the NBA game?
I don't know. I was working the NHL game.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
I did not know that.
I did not know that. Well, okay. So if it was up against a rerun of Modern Family on ABC and America's Got Talent on NBC, just to name a show, do you think it would have done much better numbers?
No.
No, I don't either.
Because as Bill McCuddy said, right, I don't think that the audience that's watching those sporting events is like, gee, if only, you know, I'm so torn. Do I watch Golden State versus Toronto in the NBA Final game, or do I...
Or is Bryan Cranston going to finally get the Tony he's on?
Exactly. Right, exactly. Or let's watch, well, there you go. I'm trying to come up with another example. Does Hadestown win the... who knows. So 5 million, so just comparatively speaking, what does the Oscars do?
Oh.
18?
Yeah, 18 or 20.
And back in the day?
Oh. 54 million in 97, the year Titanic was up. I mean, that's what everybody points to, because the problem with the Oscars is everybody says no one's seen the movies.
Right.
Well, that goes got back a horse to in the race. Yeah, well, that, yeah. I mean, that's why I don't understand why it's a television show.
I don't know. Well,
and subject to getting counter-programmed by things like an NBA final. And
so was that the biggest audience that the Oscars ever had, was the Titanic year? Or back in
the... No, I think in the 60s and stuff, when there was nobody... Yeah, there was no cable.
Around. There were more choices the year Titanic came out. I think the internet was probably around.
Hey, Siri. What's the biggest audience the Oscar telecast has ever had?
You should say search the web.
Okay, I found this on the web for what's the biggest audience the Oscar telecast ever had.
All right. Check it out. Thanks, Siri. Looks like it was in 1969. Oh, wait a minute. No, since 1969. All right, resume. Talk amongst yourselves.
Okay. How are you, Bill?
Let's get cheesecake.
Fine.
All right. Well, what's on the show next week, Bill Brigold?
Well, Goy Story 4.
Toy Story 4. Okay. And we have some other stuff opening up. Yesterday.
No, not for 2 weeks.
That's 2 weeks. All right, so we got Toy Story 4.
I saw that yesterday.
All right, we'll talk about that in 2 weeks. And we'll talk about that on the CUNY show. Again, our CUNY show is running this Friday on All Arts, and check that out. And we'll talk about Toy Story next week. And you could reach me at Neil Rose and Apples. You could reach Bill McCuddy at Bill McCuddy.
At Bill McCuddy. Couldn't
and
be easier.
Bill Bergoli is on Instagram.
Makes it all the more disappointing, right? That you're
at
not
Bill
following
Bergoli.
Me.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. That's Bergoli. And before we go, did you find that the biggest audience, Bill?
I have no idea. This makes no sense to me.
All right. Well, that'll be a mystery.
What is the internet? I'm really not sure.
Maybe we'll answer next week on the program.
Fucking Siri.
Well, there you go. What do we do here every week, Bill McCuddy?
I'm not sure. And I'm here.
That's right.
We watch the bad movies so you don't have
to. That's true. We do. And that Dead Don't Die is a bad movie. But I bet you Bill McCuddy is going to come back and tell me, you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I do that every week.
That's what's going to happen. All right. So anyway, thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. And we'll sit around talking movies again with you next week.